KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Congress would basically be impotent and wholly dependent upon the president's support to have any of its actions given effect.
Backlash over a spending freeze memo raises bigger questions about checks and balances in American democracy.
For Wednesday, January 29th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Meanwhile, unions and lawyers who represent federal workers are telling them to just say no to the Trump administration offer to resign.
What a reckless and irresponsible thing to do, to send out something like that.
Also, for students across the U.S., the latest report card for subjects like math and reading is in.
It's not great.
Our lowest performers today are scoring lower than our lower performers did 30 years ago.
Except for Louisiana, where fourth graders are reading better than before pandemic school shutdowns.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump's pick to be Health and Human Services Secretary was on Capitol Hill today for the start of his confirmation hearings. Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee seemingly largely supportive of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., while Democrats posed tough questions about his past disavowals of vaccines. Here's NPR's Lexi Schapitl.
Throughout the 3.5-hour hearing, Kennedy sought to assure Democratic senators that he supports vaccines and would not discourage their use as HHS secretary. But Democrats repeatedly confronted Kennedy with his past statements calling vaccines unsafe and ineffective. Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse told Kennedy he needs to dig out of a pretty deep hole.
We've just had a measles case in Rhode Island, the first since 2013. And frankly, you frighten people.
Kennedy has pushed misleading claims about vaccines for decades, including as the chair of an anti-vaccine nonprofit. Lexi Schapitl, NPR News, The Capitol.
President Trump assigned a sweeping executive action that aims to expand school choice. It would free up federal money for families to use toward private schools, NPR's Janaka Meadow reports.
The executive order is wide-reaching and involves several government agencies. It directs the Department of Education to prioritize school choice programs through discretionary grants. The Ed Department and the Department of Health and Human Services have been asked to issue guidance to states about how they can use federal dollars for private schools. And Trump directed Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth to come up with a plan for how military families could use money from the Department of Defense to send their kids to a school of their choosing. EdChoice, a group that advocates for school choice, celebrated the move, while the National Education Association, one of the country's largest teachers' unions, says it's an overreach to, quote, steal money from public school students to fund private school vouchers. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
President Trump, speaking on the campaign trail last year, talked about imposing up to 60% tariffs against Chinese goods, threatening to renew a trade war. Trump has not indicated exactly what level of tariffs might be levied against China, though. The Federal Reserve has wrapped up its two-day meeting in Washington, opting to stand pat on short-term interest rates, the central bank citing the fact it cut rates three times last year and therefore can afford to take a go-slow approach now. Fed Chair Jerome Powell, in his end-of-meeting statement, said the Fed is well-positioned whichever direction the economy heads going forward.
If the economy remains strong and inflation does not continue to move sustainably toward 2%, we can maintain policy restraint for longer. If the labor market were to weaken unexpectedly, or inflation were to fall more quickly than anticipated, we can ease policy accordingly.
While the Fed said inflation remains somewhat elevated, it also said the labor market is solid and it will continue to monitor developments. Stocks lost ground on Wall Street following the Fed's announcement. The Dow was down 136 points, the Nasdaq down more than 100. This is NPR. In a desert 90 miles from the glitz of Las Vegas, there exists one of the world's most top-secret nuclear weapons labs. NPR's Jeff Bromfield has been granted extraordinary access to it and brings us a report on how things there might change under the Trump administration.
In Nevada, nearly 1,000 feet underground is a network of tunnels where American scientists studied nuclear weapons. David Funk is one of them. He says these shafts were dug for underground nuclear testing.
Yeah, this was designed to be nuclear test location originally, and now we do only subcritical experiments in this location.
Subcritical experiments test the plutonium in nuclear bombs without setting them off. It's the way America has done it for more than 30 years, but some fear that could soon change. China and Russia may be preparing to test their weapons, and several people close to the Trump administration have also said that the U.S. should be ready to test again. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Genetic diversity is important to the survival of both plants and animal species, but it appears to be on the decline, at least two-thirds of animal and plant populations. That's according to research published today in the journal Nature. Researchers say they examined data for 628 species studied between 1985 and 2019. The greatest losses in genetic variation were seen in birds and mammals. Higher genetic diversity has been linked to greater survivability of plants and animals. Crude oil futures prices, after briefly moving higher, hit their lowest settlement date of the year. Oil down $1.15 a barrel today to settle at $72.62 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The White House this afternoon rescinded a memo that ordered a government spending freeze. But the White House says the overall effort remains, that effort being aligning government programs with Trump's priorities. All this comes after swift backlash and a full day of confusion over the memo's release. So what does it all mean for Trump's attempts to wrest control of the U.S. government? NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Mary Louise.
Okay, so what does it all mean? It sounds like the memo is out, but the intent behind it very much continues?
Yeah, I mean, this much we know. Okay, the original two-page memo that ordered a freeze of a lot of federal funding has now been rescinded. That order was supposed to take effect at 5 p.m. last night, but a federal judge blocked it. Bottom line, this seems to get the administration out of court. But this is not the end of it. I mean, shortly after the memo was rescinded, White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt posted on social media this afternoon, quote, "This is not a rescission of the federal funding freeze," and that the president's executive orders, quote, "on federal funding remain in full force and effect and will be rigorously implemented." In other words, their intention, like you said, remains to cut programs they don't like, which is not unusual for new administrations to want to cut discretionary programs. The problem with yesterday's memo was that it was so vague, it caused mass confusion across the country and seemed to indicate it would stop funding programs, even ones specifically authorized by Congress, if Trump didn't like them.
Right. And what I'm trying to work out is, could that still happen, the stopping of funding programs, even ones authorized by Congress, given that the White House is contending, hey, the funding freeze is on?
Yeah, it's not clear what they intend to target exactly. You know, they say they don't like diversity programs, climate change initiatives, and other things like that. But what the memo did yesterday was call into question whether this administration will honor funding programs that came into that were passed by Congress before Trump came into office. Here's Stephen Vladeck, constitutional law professor at Georgetown University.
What the memo is effectively claiming is that Congress is most important. It's first, its most basic regulatory power under the Constitution, the power to spend money, is actually entirely dependent upon the president's beneficence. That's never been the understanding. And a world in which that was the law would be a world in which Congress would basically be impotent and wholly dependent upon the president's support to have any of its actions given effect.
Yeah, this country was designed to have a system of checks and balances. Other presidents have also chafed at the limitations of, you know, the presidency. But the Congress and courts have been things that they've had to run up against. And this president seems intent to take it farther than other presidents in the past.
Well, big picture, we are now, what, 10 days into Trump's second term. There has been a fire hose of executive actions, orders, changes, and so forth. My question Is that deliberate? Is it part of a strategy?
Yeah, it seems to be ripped from the Trump playbook of distracting, trying to confuse, to gain attention for what they want us all to pay attention to. Something former Trump strategist Steve Bannon used to talk a lot about. The idea is what you've seen. Make things unclear. Make people exhausted. Make it harder for the media to focus on one thing and make it harder for the opposition to organize a message around what to focus on. But the backlash to this spending freeze memo shows that there are limits to that kind of strategy. Just because something is done fast doesn't necessarily mean it's the best way to run the government. And this is now the first major misstep by the Trump administration. But don't think this is going to mean any kind of dialing back.
Right.
Trump wants to test the powers of and the limits of the presidency. And we're going to see just how far Congress and the courts will let him go.
Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You got it.
Think of a nuclear weapons test and you might visualize a mushroom cloud over the desert.
3, 2, 1.
But for the past 30 years, the U.S. has been running its tests using computers. NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more on how chips have replaced bombs and why some fear there could soon be a return to real-world explosions.
Just outside the Bay Area at a government laboratory in Livermore, California, there's a building that looks like it's a tech company data center. But the computer is locked inside a special classified room.
We're going to go into a vault, so I'm just asking you one more time to make sure you don't have anything transmitting. Check your pockets, or else you get to tour security later on.
Terry Quinn oversees high-performance computing at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. She's leading a select group of journalists inside the vault. There are rows and rows of black boxes filled with high-powered computer processors.
From here back to the wall is El Capitan and its file system.
El Capitan is the Department of Energy's newest supercomputer.
We named it after Yosemite. There's a very prominent granite there, and it's in California.
This supercomputer is among the world's most powerful. Quinn opens one of the black boxes. Inside are racks and racks of microprocessors bristling with fiber optic cables.
This is how it's packed. It's very, very dense.
This machine is designed to carry out more than 2 quintillion calculations per second. And it has just one job, to visualize the explosion of a thermonuclear warhead. Rob Neely heads weapons simulation and computing at the lab. He says this new machine can do it all.
Button to boom. So everything from the weapon is just sitting there to full yield.
So this is really where the test happens now, inside these machines.
Yes.
Exactly. This is the new test facility.
It wasn't always this way. America began testing nuclear weapons in the atmosphere, then moved underground in the 1960s. It kept testing in tunnels and boreholes all the way until the 1990s, more than 1,000 nuclear tests in total. Hans Christensen tracks nuclear weapons globally for the Federation of American Scientists. He says after the Cold War ended, politicians wanted to show the nuclear arms race had also ended, and so they decided to stop nuclear testing.
It was very much an attempt to look around and see what can we do that makes it clear that we're not just talking about the end of the Cold War. We're serious about it. We're willing to do some things.
And it was possible to end testing thanks to new technologies like lasers and supercomputers. Scientists could rely on small experiments and simulations instead of mushroom clouds. To this day, scientists who work on America's nuclear weapons certify that the stockpile is safe and reliable. And yet, Christensen says he believes the world is inching towards new nuclear testing.
The risk is significant, and it's significant because of this new dynamic that is not just military, but it's political.
Christensen says he believes that nuclear testing or the threat of nuclear testing could be used as a show of force by a leader like Russian President Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump.
If the Trump administration needed to do some chest thumping and decided it was necessary to pop a nuke, they could absolutely rupture the situation.
Because the current situation where nobody's testing is entirely voluntary. Tong Zhao is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
If the United States resumes nuclear testing, I think there's a very high chance that China will follow suit.
But China's tests will be about more than politics. Remember how the U.S. had around 1,000 nuclear tests under its belt? Well, China has only done 45 nuclear tests. Today, it's rapidly growing its nuclear arsenal, and Zhao believes testing could help it learn as it goes.
China could gain much more technologically from resuming nuclear testing than the United States and Russia.
For now, it doesn't look like the Trump administration, Russia, or China will test a nuclear weapon soon, but all three nations are updating their nuclear test sites. The world's nuclear ceasefire is increasingly seeming like a tentative truce. Jeff Brumfiel, NPR News.
President Trump keeps repeating his desire to buy a certain Arctic territory.
Well, we need Greenland for national security purposes. I've been told that for a long time.
Greenland is rich in natural resources and strategic for shipping routes as Arctic ice melts. And we should say here, Greenland is part of Denmark. It is not for sale. And even if it were, Trump could face a competing claim from one of America's closest allies. From London, NPR's Lauren Freire explains.
In 1917, sending our boys across to make the world safe for democracy.
1917 was a big year. The U.S. entered World War I. Russia had a revolution. One of the lesser-known events was a deal in which the U.S. paid Denmark $25 million for what are now called the U.S. Virgin Islands, and in exchange, the U.S. recognized Denmark's claim to Greenland. They signed a bilateral treaty. But another country was also involved.
The other country was United Kingdom.
Tom Hoyum served as Denmark's representative in Greenland. He visited 46 times, wrote a book about it, and is an expert on the territory's history. He explains that the UK was part of those treaty talks because of Canada, which is right next to Greenland and was under British control back then. And Hoyum says the UK made a claim of its own.
They were granted the right that if Denmark got this stupid idea to sell Greenland, then the United Kingdom had the first right to buy it or to be consulted.
So if Trump tries to buy Greenland, he may have to ask the UK first. Now, this quirk of history, which Hoyum describes, is not well known. It's not mentioned in the 1917 treaty and is probably not legally binding, says Jennifer Spence, an Arctic expert at Harvard.
If we started opening up historical agreements on all former colonies of different countries, things would get pretty chaotic pretty quickly. Russia could come to the United States and ask for Alaska back.
No matter what officials may have said back in 1917, the UK Foreign Office tells NPR it has no plans to get involved now and considers this a matter for the people of Greenland and Denmark. Aya Chemnitz is a Greenlander who serves in Denmark's parliament and finds all this talk of buying and selling.
I think it's disrespectful towards the people living in Greenland. I think it's important to say that Greenland is not for sale. We live in 2025. You can't claim another person or this country is owning you. No.
She says the future of Greenland should be up to Greenlanders. And polling shows they don't want to be bought. Not by an old imperial power or a new one. Lauren Freier, NPR News, London.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The mother of all report cards is out today, the nation's report card, that is. Every 2 years, the assessment gives us a sense of how students are doing in subjects like math and reading. The latest data comes 5 years after a pandemic that massively disrupted learning. The results give us a sense of how much students have since been able to recover, and to be frank, they're not great. NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta has been sifting through the data for us and is here to explain more. Hey there.
Hey, Scott.
Nice to have you on All Things Considered.
It's great to be here.
Before we get into the results, can you give us a sense of what the nation's report card actually measures?
Yeah, so the National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP as we call it, it's really considered the gold standard as far as student achievement tests go. It covers a bunch of subjects, but every other year, a big sample of fourth and eighth graders across the country are tested in the big ones, math and reading. And the results from 2022 were really the first ones that we got after the pandemic, and they were dire. Mm-hmm. So this time the hope was that kids would rebound from the pandemic, and really they did not.
We're talking about two subjects here, math and reading. Never in my life have I picked math over reading, but we'll do it here. Walk us through how students did in math.
Well, I personally love math, but I'm happy to start there because it sounds like a lot of other students do too. We have some good news there. On average, fourth graders who took the test about a year ago, they did better in math in 2024 than they did in 2022.
Okay.
And if you look at the scores on average for eighth grade, they held steady between that same time period. But Scott, if you really dig into the data, what's troubling is that the lowest performers and the highest performers, the gap between them is widening. And it's also really important to note that both grades are still doing worse than before the pandemic, than 2019. There was actually only one state where fourth graders improved in math compared to before COVID, and that's Alabama.
Well, interesting. Any other ideas or thoughts as to why eighth graders did worse than fourth graders here?
So that's the thing that, you know, about the nation's report card is it sheds light on where students are at academically, but there aren't a lot of whys here. It doesn't explain much. But I did talk to Lisa Ash. She's a math specialist. She's on the National Assessment Governing Board.
One of the things that I think about is that today's eighth graders were in fourth grade when they were sent home to do at-home learning. So I think that's had an impact.
So basically what she's saying is fourth graders who just took the test were in kindergarten when the pandemic hit. And she says maybe they were able to better respond to accelerated learning when they got back in school than the students who are now in eighth grade.
So what about reading then?
So reading is mostly bad news. On average, students in both grades did a lot worse than they have in a long time. I spoke to the commissioner of the National Center for Education Statistics, Peggy Carr. She oversees the nation's report card.
Our lowest performers today are scoring lower than our lower performers did 30 years ago. That's how low these scores historically have dropped.
And Scott, you can hear just how concerned she is about that fact. It's true of both fourth and eighth graders. But Carr also did point out, once again, there is some hope in reading, and this time it's in Louisiana. Fourth graders there did better than they did in 2019 this time around. So we got to figure out what they're doing right there.
Broadly, though, across the whole country, is this, again, just all about the pandemic, do we think?
No, that's really important. It certainly did not help, but declines in math and reading started well before COVID, and education researchers aren't exactly sure why. But here's the thing. In the past few years, a lot of states and districts have revamped reading instruction to be more based in research, and so we'll be watching in the coming years to see if that helps students turn a pretty big corner.
Janaki Mehta, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
For more than 470 days, Israeli and American and Palestinian families have been waiting, waiting for family members and loved ones to come home to them. Now, with the ceasefire in Gaza holding so far, prisoner for hostage exchanges are underway. The International Committee of the Red Cross helps facilitate these swaps, and here to talk through how they work and how they're going is Jacob Kurtzer, spokesman for the Red Cross and on the line from Tel Aviv. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So as I understand it, the Red Cross works to facilitate the transfer both of Israeli hostages who have been held by Hamas, also of Palestinian prisoners who've been held by Israel. Is that right?
That's correct. Our role in the ongoing agreement is to implement the agreement that the parties themselves signed. In all these matters, our job is to act at the request of the parties and to facilitate the safe release and transfer of both the hostages and the detainees.
Let's start with the first group, the hostages who've been held by Hamas. How many have you been working with and how's it been going?
Since the most recent ceasefire agreement has been signed, there have been two hostage release efforts. The first in which three people were released and transferred by our colleagues back to their homes, and the second in which four people were released and transferred to their homes.
And take us inside the operation. Who's there from the Red Cross?
What you see may look like a drive, but it requires a lot of preparation and a lot of technical planning and considerations. The situation in Gaza, many of the roads have been destroyed. There is an expectation that there still remains unexploded ordnance around. We know that these individuals have experienced a lot of trauma, and so we always make sure to the best of our abilities, that we have doctors on hand who can apply any necessary immediate medical care. And we consider the fact that when they see us, it can be a very difficult moment for them.
Yeah. As you nod to, in such a fast-moving situation, you must be having to adjust on the fly when you get there, and the conditions are not what you thought they were going to be. Do you also have security personnel there?
No, I think that's a really important point that you raise. We are unarmed. And we operate again with the consent of the parties. And we achieve this consent through what we call bilateral and confidential dialogue. We're in constant communication with everyone. So our colleagues are unarmed. We have people on our staff who are security experts who assess environments and make determinations, but we don't have a security escort in the way that you might be thinking. And so, again, our ability to influence or impact the means or the manner in which release transfer takes place is really quite limited.
So meanwhile, the Red Cross is also coordinating the near simultaneous release of Palestinian detainees who've been held in Israel. And I gather in some ways that is more complex. How so?
Well, each operation is complex in its own unique and special way. Again, as the request of the parties and with the consent of the parties, we have been asked to facilitate the return of detainees from places of detention to different authorities. The complexity is for us, there are a variety of different places they go. And so we have to be prepared again, not necessarily knowing all the details until very close to the last minute, to ensure that we have the equipment, the vehicles, the personnel, the staff, and the medical support as well to carry out those detention releases.
Jacob Kurtzer, communications coordinator with the International Red Cross, speaking with us there from Tel Aviv. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
A woman is a so-called dreamer brought to the United States as a child. Now that she's grown up and a mother, she asks what happens if deportations pull her family apart.
Will he remember me? If I'm gone, when I see him again, is he still going to hug me? Is he still going to smile when he sees me? I don't want to think about these things, but I do.
A family prepares on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Coming up, new fiction tells the story of a family across generations.
It's really about the emotion and the culture and the stories that have helped to shape the family.
The novel Good Dirt, after this summary of today's news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump has a new plan to use the Guantanamo Bay detention facility in Cuba for migrants who have been deported. Trump made the announcement during a bill signing today for the Laken Riley Act, expanding the scope of those who can be arrested, detained, and deported by ICE officials. It was named for the Georgia nursing student killed by a man who was in the U.S. illegally and had a criminal record. This was Trump's first bill signing ceremony since returning to the White House.
We have 30,000 beds in Guantanamo to detain the worst criminal illegal aliens threatening the American people. Some of them are so bad we don't even trust the countries to hold them because we don't want them coming back, so we're going to send them out to Guantanamo.
But it's not clear what will be required for the facility to provide the 30,000 beds that Trump is promising. Critics say the facility has been rife with subpar conditions for detainees. Israel says its military will remain in the occupied West Bank even after its newest operation that began earlier this month is over in Gaza. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf explains.
Israel's Defense Minister Israel Katz told troops in the Jenin refugee camp that the neighborhood, quote, will not return to what it was. He added that Israeli forces will remain there, something that has not happened after previous operations and would be a shift in Israeli policy. The refugee camp has long been a militant stronghold, but it's also home to many families. Majdi Owais fled with his three children last week and described the scene to NPR in a voice memo. He said Israeli soldiers ordered them to leave over a loudspeaker, telling them, "We want to turn this camp into Jabalia," referring to a city in northern Gaza that was devastated in the war. The Israeli military says Palestinians have left Jenin willingly. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks finished lower on Wall Street today. You're listening to NPR News. In New Orleans, officials are outlining extra security for the French Quarter ahead of the Super Bowl next month. NPR's Debbie Elliott tells us this comes in response to an act of terrorism on New Year's Day that killed 14 people and injured dozens more.
The plan is to establish an enhanced security zone around Bourbon Street, with Louisiana State Police operating checkpoints to enter. Governor Jeff Landry says only small bags will be allowed and are subject to search.
To prevent and deter the introduction of any destructive explosive materials in the French Quarter, coolers and ice chests will be prohibited.
The man who drove a truck into a New Year's crowd on Bourbon Street had earlier placed explosive devices around the French Quarter packed in coolers. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
More than 3 weeks after the destructive wildfires here in the Los Angeles area, a huge benefit concert for relief efforts will be held tomorrow. Fire Aid, featuring music from artists such as Stevie Wonder, Lady Gaga, Sting, and many others, will be held at the Intuit Dome and Kia Forum in Inglewood. It will also be streamed on various sites, including YouTube, Apple TV, and Prime Video. The proceeds will help rebuild communities devastated by the recent wildfires. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today, policymakers at the Federal Reserve voted to hold interest rates steady. No surprise there to financial markets, which expected the decision, but likely a disappointment for President Trump, who says he wants to see lower borrowing costs. NPR's Scott Horsley joins me. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So this is interesting because the central bank cut interest rates, I think, the last three times they met. Why did they decide not to cut them today?
Well, a couple of reasons. You know, prices are still climbing faster than the Fed would like, and progress on inflation has kind of stalled in recent months. At the same time, the job market has been remarkably resilient. You know, employers added more than 250,000 jobs last month. So Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and his colleagues don't feel like they need to cut rates to goose the economy. They can afford to just take their time and see how things develop.
Right now, we feel like we're in a very good place. Policy is well positioned. The economy's in quite a good place, actually, as well. So we feel like we don't need to be in a hurry to make any adjustments.
Now, the stock market was a little rattled when the Fed statement first came out this afternoon. Investors worried we might be stuck with higher interest rates indefinitely. But Powell's news conference seemed to soothe the markets a little bit. You know, the Fed does expect to see further progress on inflation. It just might take a while.
Okay, so the markets are reassured. What about people, families, businesses? What does this mean for us?
Well, for the time being, it means interest rates are going to stay elevated, not as high as they were. You know, the Fed did cut rates by a full percentage point during the fall, but high. And, you know, for people trying to borrow money to buy a car or grow a business or carrying a balance on their credit card, that does mean they're going to pay more. On the other hand, for people with savings in the bank, it means, you know, they're going to get a little bit more interest. There has been a bit of a disconnect between the short-term borrowing costs that the Fed sets and long-term interest rates on things like mortgages, which rise and fall with the bond market. Mortgage rates have actually been creeping up in recent months. They're now almost 7%. And that has really been a drag on the housing market. We got numbers last week showing that 2024 was the slowest year for home sales in almost three decades. Overall, the economy has weathered high interest rates fairly well, but Powell conceded that the high prices do remain a hardship for a lot of people.
For lower income households, they're under significant pressure. And in the aggregate, the numbers are good, but we know that people at the lower end of the income spectrum are struggling with costs, and really it's high inflation for the basics of life.
Lower income families spend more of their budgets on necessities like housing and groceries and energy, and so they're particularly vulnerable when those prices go up.
Now, Scott, back to the point that President Trump says interest rates are too high. I know last week he told the World Economic Forum he was going to demand lower rates, which prompts this question: is the president on a collision course with the Fed?
Possibly. But Powell, who is always a diplomat, is trying to do some defensive driving here. He insists he and his colleagues will set interest rates as they always have, with an eye towards stable prices and maximum employment, and that they be swayed by jawboning from the president. But, you know, Powell, who took plenty of flack from Trump during his first term in the White House, is trying very hard not to pick a fight with the president.
I'm not going to have any response or comment whatsoever on what the president said. It's not appropriate for me to do so. The public should be confident that we will continue to do our work as we always have.
Even though Trump says he wants lower interest rates, some of the president's own policies could make that harder. You know, if widespread tariffs or deportations push prices up, it's going to be that much more difficult for the Fed to lower rates. But Powell said today, as he has before, it's too soon to know what tariffs or immigration or tax policy is going to look like. So it's wait and see. And in the meantime, interest rates will stay where they are.
All righty, Scott Horsley there with the news. The Federal Reserve has voted to hold interest rates steady. Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
It's been just a day since an email from the Trump administration hit federal workers' inboxes, inviting nearly all federal employees to resign. They were told if you do it by February 6, you can keep your pay through the end of September. Already, unions and attorneys who represent federal employees are sending out their own urgent message. Don't resign. NPR's Andrea Hsu has more.
Jim Eisenman was in the middle of teaching a law and policy class yesterday when a student brought up the Trump administration's offer.
I had no idea what she was talking about.
Eisenman worked inside the federal government before becoming partner with the Alden Law Group representing federal workers. Once he heard the details, he knew it didn't sound right. The memo from the Office of Personnel Management, or OPM, told workers they could resign under something called a deferred resignation program. Eisenman knew there was no such thing.
It's not based on any law or regulation or anything really other than an idea they cooked up to get federal employees out of the government.
Federal employees suspected as much, too. On Reddit and elsewhere, they expressed confusion and disbelief. The memo was unclear. Could they really quit and still get paid for 8 months? Later, OPM sent out an FAQ clarifying that employees who choose to resign would not be expected to work, except in rare cases. Still, Eisenman is cautioning federal workers to be wary. Even if they accept the offer to be paid through September 30th?
There's no guarantee other things won't happen to them between now and then, like they won't get fired for some other reason.
Another red flag for federal workers was that the email came directly from OPM. That's not normal. Federal workers say communications regarding personnel matters always come from their agencies. Matthew Biggs says the administration doesn't have the authority to go around the agencies. He's president of the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. It's a union representing roughly 30,000 federal workers.
What a reckless and irresponsible thing to do, to send out something like that.
Biggs is calling the email a resignation threat, pointing to language in the memo that warns employees who choose to remain in their jobs that the future of their positions and their agencies is not assured. Now, the OPM email that went out noted that some federal employees are not eligible to resign, including people working in immigration enforcement and national security. Nevertheless, Biggs says some of his members who are doing those jobs got the email, including immigration judges and others.
We represent people that do cybersecurity at NASA and other places. At the Navy Yards, we represent folks that prepare these submarines and these aircraft carriers to go out to sea.
He can't believe that they, too, have been invited to quit.
What if all these people accepted the offer? What would that do to our national security? What would it do to public services in general?
Other federal employee unions call the resignation offer a hostile effort to disparage employees and disrupt essential services like food safety inspections or taxpayer assistance. One called it a purge of the federal government.
That's absolutely false.
Caroline Levitt is White House press secretary. She says this is a great option for federal workers who don't want to return to the office 5 days a week.
This is a suggestion to federal workers that they have to return to work. And if they don't, then they have the option to resign. And this administration is very generously offering to pay them for 8 months.
It's likely that in a workforce of more than 2 million people, there will be some takers, especially among those who do work remotely and can't easily relocate to be near a federal office. But for many federal employees, serving the American people is what they chose to do. Only now under Trump, those who want to keep doing it may not have that opportunity. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has ordered the Pentagon's Inspector General to investigate the conduct of retired Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Mark Milley. Milley had clashed at times with President Trump during his first term. Now, Trump's defense secretary wants to determine whether it is appropriate that Milley be reduced in rank from his current 4 stars. NPR's Tom Bowman joins me to talk about this. Hey, Tom.
Hey there.
Reducing a 4-star general in rank is not a thing to be undertaken lightly. What more can you tell us?
Well, we don't have a lot of detail why this is being done or any specific conduct here. The Pentagon put out a release late last night saying only, quote, undermining the chain of command is corrosive to our national security and restoring accountability is a priority for the Defense Department under President Trump's leadership. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth also revoked Milley's security clearance as well as his security detail. He had 24/7 security provided by the Army. Security details were earlier revoked, of course, for former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. All three men were involved in the U.S. airstrike back in 2020 that killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. And there's an ongoing threat against him from Iran.
And Tom, I'm trying to square this up with what President Biden did on his way out the door. He gave General Milley and some others immunity from prosecution.
That's right, Mary Louise. It applies to federal and military law. What's being proposed here is administrative action.
Okay. So not a lot of detail on what may come next or what conduct may be under review, but clearly Trump and Milley had their moments, had a rocky relationship.
Absolutely. No, Trump chose Milley to be his senior military advisor back in 2019, but the relationship soured over time and only got worse. For example, Trump wanted to use active duty troops in American cities. Milley and others talked him out of it. Trump suggested shooting protesters in the legs, clearly an illegal order that Milley and others opposed. And there were times when Milley convinced him to change course on policy, like removing all U.S. troops from Syria. Milley told him they needed to continue going after the remnants of the Islamic State, and they're still there. The big rupture, Mary Louise, came in June 2020 after the protests following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Trump and Milley walked from the White House across Lafayette Square, as you may remember. Mm. Milley realized it was clearly it was a political photo op and soon apologized, saying, "I should not have been there," and that it created a perception of the military getting involved in domestic politics. And the military must remain apolitical. That really upset Trump. And Milley had a not-too-subtle parting shot at Trump when he retired in September 2023. Let's listen.
"We don't take an oath to a king or a queen or to a tyrant or a dictator. And we don't take an oath to a wannabe dictator. We don't take an oath to an individual. We take an oath to the Constitution, and we take an oath to the idea that it's America, and we're willing to die to protect it."
Wannabe dictator, we heard Milley saying there, although he notably did not mention Trump by name.
No, that's right. And civil-military relations experts tell me going after a retired senior officer like this is extremely rare, maybe unprecedented.
And PR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. In the opening pages of a new novel, Good Dirt, a young girl is playing with her older brother. They've decorated an old stoneware jar, adding a baseball cap, a handlebar mustache made out of paper. The jar ends up another character in a family photograph with the girl, the boy, and their parents. The boy, we soon learn, is Baz. His sister is Ebby. And that old jar is a cornerstone of their family's story, which is told over generations. The book is Good Dirt, and author Charmaine Wilkerson joins us now to discuss it. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thanks very much.
Charmaine, I just want to start at the beginning, if we can, with the idea that inspired for you the story of Ebby and Baz and of this jar. I want to know, where did you start? What character came first for you?
Well, the character that came first was Ebby. Ebby Freeman is Ebony Freeman, and she really just popped right into my head on the worst day of her life, and that's connected to the thought that sort of inspired this character. It really came from an emotional question in my mind and in my life.
Tell us a bit more about Ebby. Who is she? What is she like?
Ebby is an African-American young woman who's grown up under privileged circumstances. She lives in this gorgeous community in Connecticut. She loves being from an old New England family, but Ebby has decided that she needs to run away from home at age 29. She goes to France temporarily because she's convinced that the only way to distance herself from painful memories from her past, a family tragedy, and a very embarrassing and public romantic breakup, is to get away from everyone she knows and everything she knows.
What is it that made you want to explore this idea of how a personal tragedy can shape a person's identity and really the course of their life?
I began my professional life in television news. And so from a very young age, from age 21, I would find myself walking into a person's home on the worst day of their life. And I think that you can identify with this, meeting people under terrible circumstances and then going home later and wondering, how will they move forward? How will they do this? Especially when they've become news, when their personal pain is now in the public eye.
This book takes two tracks. There is, of course, the story of Ebby and her family in the present day, but we also begin to learn the stories of previous generations of the family and the story of that old stoneware jar that we later learned to call Old Mo. And you hint at this in the opening pages of your book, that the jar is a character, that it's really a part of Ebby and Baz's family. Can you just tell us why it was so important?
So you hit on the opening scene in which she and her brother, Ebby and Baz, are playing around with the jar. They're decorating it. They're dressing it up like a person because they're still children. But it is of great serious importance because it is a jar that has come into their family by way of an enslaved ancestor. And the story of how that jar ends up being made in the American South and finds its way to Massachusetts and remains in that family for generations and becomes so important to the family is that sort of backstory of the Freeman family.
I won't give away much of the plot, but I have to say one of the things I found most compelling when I was reading this book was how deeply you dove into the history of pottery making, stretching from the American South all the way to West Africa. What made you decide to dive into that so deeply, and how did you approach that part of your writing?
For me, it was a process of discovery. I'm one of those writers who I start from a point of emotion. You know, this character came to me, and I thought, I'm going to follow her. The very first thing I wrote about Ebby, there's a scene in which an antique jar falls from a table. And I started to look into the history of what that jar would be. Where would it come from? And really, so much of that story came from a learning process for me. I learned about the mass production of stoneware by enslaved people, usually men, primarily in the part of the American South that we now call South Carolina, also Georgia, because they had special soil that allowed them to make this kind of clay. And the title of the book, Good Dirt, is a reference in part to the idea of having good dirt that allows you to make very special clay. So much of the story was the result of my own exploration. Things that I did not know or might have heard of became the backstory for this young woman, Ebbie Freeman.
The central role that this jar plays in Ebbie's family and her story made me think a lot about the impact of things that we inherit and the way that they impact our identities and our families and how we see ourselves. And I just wonder, is there an object like that jar that plays a specific role of significance in your own family?
I come from a very different family from the fictional Ebbie. So, across two or three generations, my elders came from different countries and different cultures. But in my debut novel, Black Cake, I invent a character for whom a very prized inheritance is a recipe, and that is something that I inherited from my own mother. She really did make what some people call black cake, what she called rum pudding. The recipe was important. The stories were important, and really what the story Good Dirt is at the heart is not a story about a tangible inheritance, Old Mo, the stoneware jar. It's a story about the intangible, because there is no tangible without the intangible. If we're talking about inheritance of culture, it's really about the stories. The family feels great affection for a tangible object, this stoneware jar, but it's really about the emotion and the culture and the stories that have helped to shape the family.
I want to end, if I can, on a personal note. This book is a multi-layered, multi-generational telling of an American story. As you wrote it, what did you learn from it? What did you take away from it yourself?
I would say that in writing this, I continued to deepen my thinking about the power of stories to shape our identities. The story that is handed down from one generation to another, the story that we tell others about ourselves, and in this particular case, the stamp that trauma can leave on one's identity. So what is the challenge facing Ebbie Freeman? In a way, the challenge for her is to find a way to rewrite or reconfigure her relationship with an episode that was so traumatic in her life that it has dominated, it continues to dominate her adult life. So she's, we hope, going to find a new way to write her story.
Author Charmaine Wilkerson, her latest book is Good Dirt. Charmaine, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people.
You call yourself the Jungle King. You call yourself the Jungle King. You call yourself the Jungle King.
I found out you ain't a doggone thing, said the monkey to the lion on a bright summer day. Say, man, there's a big bad cat living down the way. You know, he talks about your folks in a heck of a way, and he says a whole lot of things that I'm sort of afraid to say. While the lion jumps salty, all full of rage, like a Harlem cat that's left in his cage. He meets the elephant up under a great big tree, and he says, now look here, big boy, it's either you or me. They fought all night and they fought all day. Man, I really don't know how, but the lion, he got away. He came back to the...